Matthew's Gospel. We're looking at the disciples, and we've been looking at chapter 16. Two things we've seen in Matthew chapter 16. Number one, the disciples realize that Jesus is incomparable. Verse 13, Matthew 16, verse 13. Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is? Who do people say I am?" Answer, "Some say John the Baptist, great preacher, prophet, reformer. John had been put to death just a few months earlier. Well, some people thought Jesus was this great prophet, come back from the dead. Others say Elijah, another great prophet and miracle worker, from much further back, 700 years earlier. Some people thought that Jesus was Elijah, come back from heaven. Others say Jeremiah, another Old Testament prophet who was taken off and lived in Egypt at the end of his life and then vanished off the page of history. Some people thought Jesus was Jeremiah returned. And others simply said, one of the prophets. We don't know who, but we're sure Jesus is one of these Old Testament prophets. Come back again." "But what about you?" Jesus asked the disciples. "Who do you say I am?" And Simon Peter answers, "You are the Christ. You are the Son of the living God. You're not just a prophet. You're not even the greatest of the prophets. You're the Christ. You're the one supreme king, the Messiah. You're the savior of the world. You're the Son of God. Different from every other man who's ever lived. You're the Son of God, and that means you're like God in every way. You share his power, you share his nature, you share his goodness, you share his glory. You're his son. That makes you incomparable." That's what Peter and the other disciples realized. And then the second thing we saw in Matthew chapter 16, Jesus, from that point on, began to teach the disciples what lay ahead for them. Verse 21, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and on the third day be raised to life. Yes, Jesus is the Messiah, and that means he's going to rule the world. Yes, Jesus is God's Son, and that means he's going to share God's glory. But first, he must travel to Jerusalem. And he must be handed over to wicked men. And he must suffer many things. And he must die. And then he'll be raised again. For Jesus, what lies ahead is shame, defeat, suffering, death. And only then will victory come. We've been thinking about the disciples and how they moved forward in their understanding. Well, there in chapter 16, there have been two huge leaps forward in their understanding. At last, they've understood clearly who Jesus is. They know he's the Messiah, the Son of God. And Jesus has begun to explain clearly to them what lies ahead for him. Suffering and death, and only then glory. Now, as we come into chapter 17, We're going to see there three more things. Firstly, we're going to see the disciples being given more insight from God. We're going to see them moving forward again in their grasp of who Jesus is and what he's going to do. God has already worked in their hearts so that they can recognize Jesus for who he is. They've had inward, secret revelation. But now they're going to see it with their own eyes. They're going to be given outward revelation. They're actually going to see the glory of Jesus Christ in a visible way. That's the first thing we're going to see in chapter 17. The disciples moving forward again in their understanding. But then secondly, we're going to see how slow they are to understand. How prone they are to misunderstand what they're seeing. We're going to see how confused they can get. And what silly things they can imagine. And then thirdly, we're going to see how patient God is with them. And how he carries on correcting their thinking. How he unravels their foolishness. How he brings them back on track when they're going off on tangents. So let's go to chapter 17. It's 6 days since the disciples had that conversation with the Lord Jesus, when Peter said, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." Chapter 17, verse 1. After 6 days, Jesus takes three of the disciples and he leads them up a high mountain by themselves. Now let's stop and ask a question. Why does Matthew mention the fact that it was 6 days on? It's quite unusual for Matthew to give us that sort of exact time note. So why is it important? Well, if you know your Old Testament properly, and I trust you all do, then you'll know why it's important. Listen to these words from the book of Exodus. It's Exodus chapter 24, verse 15. And it's talking about what happened when the Israelites came to Mount Sinai in the wilderness. This is what we read. When Moses went up on the mountain, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai. For 6 days the cloud covered the mountain. And on the seventh day, the glory of the Lord called to Moses from within the cloud. To the Israelites, the glory of the Lord looked like a consuming fire on top of the mountain. Then Moses entered the cloud as he went up on the mountain. That's the summary of what happened at Sinai. 6 days of preparation. And then after the 6 days, Moses climbs the mountain. And there, resting on the mountaintop, is the cloud of God's glory. And Moses steps into that glory cloud, and there he hears the voice of God. And there, as Moses meets with God in the cloud of glory, God speaks to him the commandments that he will pass on to the people. Well, here again in Matthew 17 now, we're reading about a man climbing a mountain after 6 days. And we're reading about God speaking from a bright cloud. That happens in verse 5. And we're reading about God's glory being revealed there on the top of the mountain. Everything here is supposed to remind us of that day when God showed his glory on Mount Sinai. When God spoke his word for his people. There's so much that's similar about what happens here and what happened back to Moses on Mount Sinai. But there are some things that are different too. And they're the things that we need to focus on. This is what we read. Jesus has led these three disciples to the top of the mountain, and there he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Yes, again, there is glory at the top of the mountain, just as there was back in Exodus. The disciples could see the glory of God there, blazing, beautiful, overwhelming. The glory of God is shining out at the top of that mountain. But where is it blazing from? It's blazing from Jesus himself. All the glory of God is shining in him and from him. It's totally different from the story of Moses at Sinai. Moses goes up onto the mountain and he's allowed to approach God's glory. He's even allowed to reflect God's glory. But Jesus isn't just another Moses. Moses was the greatest prophet of Old Testament times. He came closer to God's glory than anyone else did. But Jesus is the glory of God. He's the very center of God's glory. It's from him that God's glory was blazing. The glory isn't in the cloud. The cloud doesn't come down until verse 5. The glory is in the face of Jesus Christ. Do you understand? The disciples are seeing physically with their own eyes the truth that they already know in their hearts. They learned 6 days earlier that Jesus isn't just a prophet. He's God's son. And now they're seeing it with their own eyes. He's infinitely greater than the greatest prophet. Even than Moses. He's God's son. He shares God's glory. It blazes from his face. And just in case the disciples were to miss the point, just then, it's verse 3, there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Elijah and Moses, for a moment, are called back into this world. And again, they stand on the mountain. If Moses was the greatest prophet of Old Testament times, Elijah was number two. Moses was used by God to give the law. Elijah was the man who called God's people back to the law. Moses and Elijah, the great representatives of the law and the prophets. Well, both these men, when they lived here on earth, both of them stood on Mount Sinai at different times and met with God there. Read that about Moses already. But then later Elijah stood on the same mountain. The story is told in 1 Kings 19. And he met with God there as well. But now these two men are called back from the unseen world to stand on a mountaintop again. But who are they meeting with there on the mountaintop? They're meeting with Jesus. As we said, the glory cloud hasn't yet come down on the mountain. And yet Moses sees glory. He sees the glory of God. The same glory which Moses saw in the cloud on Mount Sinai, he's now seeing shining in the face of Jesus Christ. The same still small voice, the voice of God which Elijah heard on Horeb, is now speaking through the lips of Jesus Christ. Moses and Elijah are meeting the same God that they met on the mountaintop many hundreds of years earlier, but now they're meeting that God in Jesus Christ. They're not just meeting with another prophet. They're not meeting with a man like themselves. Moses and Elijah know that Jesus is God. He's God the Son. He's the Lord of glory. This is the same Lord Jehovah that they met on Sinai in Old Testament times. Can you see the scene? Better seen than told. two men, great men, great teachers, great preachers, great prophets, and here they are standing on the mountain again, but they're only men. They've got no glory of their own. They're like you and me, born in sin, fallible. Both men in their lifetimes made great mistakes. But between them stands Jesus. And how utterly different he is from Moses or Elijah. His face is shining like the sun. Even his clothes have become robes of divine glory. At last the disciples can see who Jesus really is. The veil's been taken away from their eyes. They see Jesus and he's incomparable. Have you ever seen Jesus like that? Have you ever found yourself overwhelmed by the realization that this man Jesus, whom we talk about so lightly, whom we sing about so lightly, is the Lord of glory? Have you ever been dazzled by Jesus, by his brightness, his purity, his sheer goodness, his holiness, his majesty, just by the fact that he is the one, the everlasting, the incomparable, that he's Jehovah, that he's the Son of God? That's what the disciples could see on the mountain. Well, you've never seen him with your physical eyes. But have you ever seen Jesus in your heart like that? You know, nowadays you hear people talking all the time about Jesus as one of the great religious leaders of the world. They talk of him as the founder of one of the world's great religions. Or even more nauseous, one of the world's faith traditions. He's there along with Muhammad and Gautama Buddha and Confucius and the rest. But what God showed the disciples on this mountain was that Jesus can't be compared with anyone. Take Moses, take Elijah, take the two greatest religious leaders of Judaism. And put them alongside Jesus and they pale into insignificance. You know, light two little candles in a dark room and they seem very bright. But then carry them out into the blaze of the midday sun and you can hardly tell if they're lit. Well, Moses and Elijah burned brightly in the darkness of Old Testament times. But now that Jesus has come into the world, now that his glory blazes like the noonday sun, who's Moses? Who's Elijah? In fact, they're not even candles beside the light of his glory. The best they are is mirrors. Any light that ever shone from Moses and Elijah was reflected light. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai, he did shine with reflected light. But the light he was reflecting was this light, the glory that can now be seen fully in the face of Jesus Christ. For a little while, the light only shone into this world off these tiny mirrors called Moses and Elijah. But now Jesus himself, in the blaze of his divine glory, is visible before the eyes of men. You know, people are so patronizing about Jesus Christ. Well, we must respect Jesus as a man of great spiritual insight. Of course, he was a man of his time, still clinging to some unscientific primitive ideas. In the last 2,000 years, well, we've learned so much more about tolerance and morality. We've made such progress in terms of social values. But for his time, Jesus did have some very enlightened views. And even now we can learn something from Jesus. Well, there were people in Jesus' own time who patronized him in just the same way. Oh, we're ready to accept that he's one of the prophets. Definitely on a par with a man like Jeremiah. Perhaps even to be compared with Elijah. But the disciples who have seen Jesus there on the mountain have seen in Jesus a glory that sets him apart from every teacher, every philosopher, every prophet, every leader. They've seen divine, unique glory in the face of Jesus Christ. And some of us have seen that glory too. Not with our eyes, but our hearts have seen it. We've read and we've listened and we've looked and we've been overwhelmed with Jesus. And we say he's incomparable. You know, I've got my heroes. I've got heroes from Bible times. And I've got heroes from secular history. I love David. I love the shepherd boy from Bethlehem who became the warrior king. What a man David was, so generous and so brave and so noble. But I see the faults in David. I see the sins, the selfishness. He's a man, just a man in the end. I can admire King David, but I can't worship him. I could never fall on my knees before David and say, I trust you totally. I'll give myself to you forever. But again and again I find myself on my knees before Jesus Christ, saying, if I can only know you, I'm satisfied. I'm awed by the Apostle Paul. The brilliance of Paul's mind, the sheer courage of that little man, the astonishing work rate. Paul is awesome by our standards. But there's nothing divine about Paul. Gets involved in blazing quarrels. Makes promises which he finds out afterwards he can't keep. Has to sheepishly apologize. He makes mistakes. I couldn't humble myself before Paul and say, thou, O Paul, art all I need. More than all in thee I find. But I find myself singing those words to Jesus Christ. Not just as an exercise, but because they're the words of my heart. You know, I listen, it's not just Bible characters. I listen to music by Beethoven. And I'm staggered by the genius of a deaf man who could produce such sheer beauty. Or I listen to recordings of Winston Churchill's speeches and I'm moved by the gritty courage and the realism, the real heroism of that man. But I'm never tempted to say, oh, I'd give up my home, I'd give up my wife, I'd give up my children, I'd give up my life to be allowed to know Beethoven or to know Churchill. But I find myself saying that about Jesus Christ every day, that he's more precious to me than my wife or than my children or than anything which I find a treasure in this world. He's incomparable. I can't find a flaw in Jesus. He is simply wonderful. And many of you say the same thing, because God has taken the veil away from your eyes. Just as he took the veil away from Peter and John and James. So that's the first thing we see here. God has given the disciples new and wonderful insight. They see the glory of Jesus in a new and incomparable way. But then the second thing, how slow the disciples are to understand, how slow to see the implications, how downright silly they can be. They've been allowed to see Jesus shining with divine glory, a glory that sets him apart from Moses or Elijah. And Peter feels he's got to say something. So what does he say? Verse 4. Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I'll put up 3 shelters. One for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Well, Peter's right about one thing. He calls Jesus Lord. He knows that at least, that it's Jesus who is the Lord. That it's Jesus who's supreme in this situation. At least he doesn't turn to Moses and call him Lord. Or turn to Elijah and say Lord to him. It's Jesus to whom he speaks. And he calls Jesus Lord. He's got that much right. But when you think about it, how confused Simon Peter is in every other way. What an incredible tangle of nonsense he comes out with. Peter has seen the glory of Jesus Christ. And now he feels he's got to do something in response to what he's seen. What should he do? Well, he says, I'll build 3 shelters. In older translations, I'll build 3 tabernacles. He'll find wood up there on the mountaintop, and he'll build 3 huts, 3 booths there on the mountaintop. Now, why does he want to do that? Well, surely it's for this reason. He wants to prolong this moment. He doesn't want this to stop. He doesn't want Jesus to come down from the mountain and to pick up where he left off. He doesn't want Jesus and himself and the other disciples to go back to the travelling and the work and the struggles and the frustrations. It's good for us to be here, he says. Down there in the world, nobody recognises Jesus for who he is. Down in the world, people think of Jesus as no more than a prophet. Down in the world, many people openly criticize and ignore Jesus. Well then, why shouldn't Jesus stay here on the mountaintop, blazing with divine glory? And then everybody can come up, and they'll see him here, and they'll be forced to recognize who he is. And they'll worship him. Jesus can reign here as king on the top of the mountain, supreme in majesty. I think that's why Peter uses this unusual word, tabernacles, booths. You know the background? There was one occasion each year when all Israelites built tabernacles. That's what happened at the great autumn feast, the Feast of Tabernacles. All the Israelites camped out in booths made of branches. And in the Old Testament, the prophets used the Feast of Tabernacles as a picture of what it would be like at the end of the world, when at last God had triumphed. Zechariah chapter 14 pictures the last great crisis of history. The last great assault of the nations against God and his people. And God wins the victory. The last climactic victory of God. And then Zechariah says this. Then the remnant from all the nations that have attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. That's Zechariah's vision. From all the world, people gather to worship God at one vast Feast of Tabernacles that goes on and on and on. Well, what's Peter saying? He's saying to Jesus, this is it! The The end of the age is here. The time has come for the victory. The last great feast of tabernacles is at hand. Let it begin. Peter really believes that the time has come for God's great final victory, for all evil to be banished from this moment. He wants Jesus to remain there on the mountain, shining with divine glory. And he can see in his mind's eye the nations of the world streaming to this mountain and gathering to worship the King in his glory and to listen to the commands of King Jesus. Well, there's only one thing wrong with Peter's dream, isn't there? And it's this. Jesus has already told them that it isn't going to be like that. Jesus has already told Peter that he must go to Jerusalem and that he must be handed over to the chief priests and that he must suffer many things and that he must be put to death. But now Peter has decided that all that can be bypassed. Peter doesn't see why Jesus should suffer many things. Peter doesn't see why Jesus should have to carry a cross, or why the disciples should have to carry a cross behind Jesus. Peter expects the festival of glory to start now. There are still Christians who think like that. They love singing songs about the triumph of Jesus, about the fact that Jesus is enthroned. But they don't really believe that the cross was all that important. And they certainly don't believe that there needs to be a cross in the life of Jesus' followers. They don't really believe that our life here in this world has got to be a life of self-denial and pain and weariness because we're following Jesus to his cross. They want the glory to dawn now. They want Christian life to be one great jamboree, one great never-ending festival. Simon Peter made that mistake. He thought that the cross could simply be crossed out of the equation. He thought that the festival of glory could begin here and now. And even more extraordinary, Peter takes it for granted that in that festival of glory, Moses and Elijah will share the honours with Jesus, the Son of God. Simon Peter is going to build three shelters, not one. He's taking it for granted that Moses and Elijah are going to stay here on earth. They're not going to return to heaven or wherever they've been. They're going to stay here on earth, and they'll be there alongside Jesus in this great endless Feast of Tabernacles. The people who come to worship at the mountain will listen to Jesus speaking his kingly words, but they'll also listen to Moses on one side of him, the lawgiver, and Elijah on the other side, the prophet. If Peter really is thinking at all about what he's saying that through all eternity to come, people will still need Moses and Elijah to teach them and to guide them. Well, isn't Peter confused? Isn't he foolish? He's seen so much, but he's not worked out what it means. He's not understood, has he, that Moses and Elijah, and for that matter, all human teachers, prophets and apostles and preachers, they all have one role, and it's to point us to Jesus. Here in this world we need them. But when the new world dawns, when Jesus does take his place on the throne worshipped by all nations, then we won't need any man to point us to Jesus. When Jesus is sitting there, blazing with his own glory, we won't need any candles burning. In the brightness of that noonday sun, isn't Peter muddled? Peter knows that Jesus is supreme. Peter knows that Jesus stands above all others. But he's not realized that in the end Jesus stands alone. That in the end Jesus is all and Jesus is everything. That he is the only Savior we need, the only teacher, the only Lord, our only God. He is the one glorious Son of God. He is the way and the truth and the life. Peter has seen so much, and yet he's so confused. Perhaps some of us here in this congregation mix with folk from some other churches, and at times we feel we know a little more than some of them. And possibly at times we start thinking that we know a lot. After all, we've got all those banner books on our shelves. And every week we have Bible preaching here. How little we know. Oh yes, there are things we've grasped. Things that have become clear as we've read Scripture together. Maybe we've caught glimpses of truth. And yet if the saints in heaven could read our thinking and hear all our words, they'd fall over themselves laughing at how silly and confused we still are. How much we have to learn, how little we've really understood about Christ. If we really understood all the implications of who Jesus is, then we would trust him perfectly, and we would love him totally, and we would serve him 100% of the time with all our energy and all our zeal. The very fact that we don't is the proof that we've not understood so much. Finally, very briefly, our third point. How patient God is with these disciples. The way that he keeps on teaching them. He's not going to leave Peter in his confusion of mind. We read this in verse 5, that even as Peter is speaking, the cloud comes down and envelops them. The same cloud that wrapped itself round Moses on Sinai is now around the disciples. And then the voice rings from the cloud. It's the voice of the Father. But now that voice has only one word to say. This is what he says. This is my Son, the Beloved, the one I love. With him I'm well pleased. Listen to him. Peter, how dare you put Moses and Elijah on a par with my Son? They're my servants, yes. They're my spokesman, yes. But Jesus is my Son. He's my only Son. He's my beloved Son. He's the one whom I love. So listen to him. The time for Moses to speak, it's passing away. The time for Elijah is coming to an end. There's only one voice that you must listen to now. There's only one at whose feet you sit. Listen to the voice of my son. Hear him. And then we read this. When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. Somehow, that voice, those words, made them aware of Jesus and his solitary glory in a way that even the vision of his brightness had not done. They were on their faces, terrified, worshipping. They knew that for all eternity Jesus would be the one. But then this one, this Jesus, came and touched them. Get up, he said. Don't be afraid. This Jesus who is the awesome Son of God, this Jesus from whom divine glory blazes, this incomparable Jesus, walks over to these frightened men and touches them. And he says, you don't need to be afraid of me. And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. Moses had vanished from their sight, and Elijah had vanished, and they had eyes for Jesus only. The mark of growth in Christian grace is that increasingly we have eyes for no one except Jesus. Yes, we read Moses, we read the prophets, we read Paul and James and John and Peter, but we don't look at them. They point us to Jesus, and we see Jesus only.